Bangladesh has chosen a new prime minister.
Why did you come here today?
I came here to see him, to congratulate him, to congrats, because yesterday, last night, couldn't sleep.
You're too excited?
Yeah, very excited.
I'm Marco Werman, the latest on an historic election. Also in Gaza, most of the schools have been damaged or destroyed, but kids are starting to go back to class.
They just want to have the possibility to learn and to be able to build a future for themselves.
And in Southeast Asia, officials are shutting down scam centers. The people who work in them are also victims.
I understand that people may feel reluctant to think of people who've been involved scamming others as victims, but that's a reality that exists.
Plus, a Japanese tap dancer brings new flavor to New York City, coming up today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us today. Leaders and policymakers from around 120 different countries are in Germany today for the start of the Munich Security Conference. Transatlantic relations, which have been strained throughout President Trump's first year back in office, are expected to take center stage. Opening today's event, German Chancellor Friedrich Merz said in German that the international world order as we have known it no longer exists. And then he switched to English.
Let me paraphrase this for our American friends in English. For three generations, trust amongst allies, partners and friends has made NATO the strongest alliance of all times. Europe knows deeply how precious this is. In the era of great power rivalry, even the United States will not be powerful enough to go it alone.
Even the United States, Merz warned the audience today. It is hard to miss the level of frustration in that short address. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry kicks things off for us today.
When U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance took to the stage at the Munich Security Conference 1 year ago, his remarks signaled that transatlantic relations were in for a rough ride.
The threat that I worry the most about vis-a-vis Europe is not Russia, it's not China, it's not any other external actor. And what I worry about is the threat from within, the retreat of Europe from some of its most fundamental values, values shared with the United States of America.
His comments at the time left European leaders reeling. This week in Munich, Matthew Whitaker, the U.S. permanent representative to NATO, took a less aggressive approach.
Fundamentally, the energy, the immigration and the free speech issues in Europe are legitimate criticisms. But at the same time, it doesn't mean we're getting a divorce. Mom and dad are still together.
Some political experts in Germany, though, don't see it that way.
I'm just not sure whether it describes a reality as we would see it here in Europe.
Thomas Kleiner-Brockhoff is director of the German Council on Foreign Relations. He says the behaviour of the US administration over the past year, including threats to take control of Greenland, have undermined so much of that trust.
He says all is good and fine. All we want is a more grown-up, more responsible Europe that spends more on defence. Well, if that was true, why would you then challenge the sovereignty of two alliance members of the same alliance that you're asking a defense contribution of 5% from? So the U.S. wants it both ways.
This year, the U.S. delegation is being led by Secretary of State Marco Rubio. Julie Smith, who served as the U.S. ambassador to NATO under the Biden administration, says that may bode well for Europe.
He has a deep commitment to Europe. He's worked closely with European allies over the years as a senator.
50 delegates from the U.S. Congress are also in Munich this weekend, along with several mayors and state governors. Smith, who's been at many of these security conferences in the past, says this sort of turnout from the U.S. is unusual.
The fact that we're seeing such a large delegation this year, I think, is a very strong indication that those who are members of Congress feel like they want to bring an alternative message to Munich, one of support, one of enthusiasm.
Transatlantic relations, though, aren't the only hot topics. The conference will also hear debates about Iran and its role in global security. Iranian government officials were disinvited from the conference last month. Reza Pahlavi, son of the former Shah of Iran and an opposition figurehead, is speaking at the event today. Demonstrations against the Iranian government are set to be held in Munich this weekend. The future of Gaza is also on the table. Farzan Akabeki and Shine, the Palestinian Minister for Foreign Affairs, was asked today whether her government can unite the Palestinian people.
Yes, it's possible, and we need to keep that hope alive because we cannot go into desperation. The Palestinians need to see something moving on the political front. We are tired from being seen with a humanitarian lens. The humanitarian lens needs a political track.
If Palestinians start seeing a future at the end of the tunnel, she said, then they'll rally behind the leadership. The war in Ukraine is also once again on the agenda for the third year in a row. Volodymyr Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, is expected to make a speech tomorrow. And Marco Rubio said today he's hoping to meet Zelensky on the sidelines of the conference. Christy Rake, director of the International Center for Defense and Security, says she expects the US will once again criticize Europe for not doing enough to support Ukraine or defend itself. And maybe, she says, that's not such a bad thing.
Maybe it would be healthy for Europeans to get another push from the US side, kind of making clear that, well, Europeans, you really need to deal with your own security and defense in future and stop expecting that the Americans will do it.
That push may come tomorrow morning when US Secretary of State Marco Rubio takes to the podium. As for US-Europe relations, though, Rubio's schedule in the days ahead may offer a clearer signal. After Munich, he travels to Slovakia and then to Hungary, two countries led by governments widely seen as sympathetic to Moscow and sceptical of the European Union. For the World, I'm Orla Barry.
Voters in Bangladesh handed a major victory to one of the country's two major political parties. Election officials announced today that the center-right Bangladesh Nationalist Party won two-thirds of the seats in parliament. The Jamaat-e-Islami Party was the other big winner. The Islamist-led coalition won its most seats ever after 17 years of effective banishment. The results signal a rightward shift in Bangladesh's politics. They're also likely to coincide with the first peaceful transition to power in the country in many years. It was only a year and a half ago when youth-led protests toppled the repressive government of Sheikh Hasina. My co-host Carolyn Beeler is in Dhaka. Here she is with the latest.
The official results just recently came down, and supporters have started to gather outside of the office of the chairman of the Bangladesh Nationalist Party, soon to be the prime minister of the country. The party has not had a majority in parliament for 20 years, and people here are excited to celebrate.
I feel like, you know, our Eid, you know, our festival is more than that, actually, yeah.
Tamanna Maser is a grandmother in a headscarf and fun glasses who lives nearby. She's been campaigning for Tariq Rahman, who leads the BNP.
Why did you come here today?
I came here to see him, to congratulate him, to congrats, because yesterday, last night, couldn't sleep.
You're too excited?
Yeah, very excited. When I give vote, I was very, very excited. I said, last three term, we couldn't put our vote. So it's like a, you know, like a party. We are very, very happy. We want our leader last 17 years.
Rahman is expected to take the oath of office as Bangladesh's new prime minister on Sunday. He is part of a powerful political dynasty, but he was in self-imposed exile while the last government was in power and only returned to Bangladesh in December.
After 17 years, we got freedom, we got to rebuild up our democracy.
Meher Kayser is another BNP supporter. He is wearing an elegant sapphire-colored shirt for the occasion.
It's tremendous for us. It's a good feeling for all people of Bangladesh.
So this feels like a win for democracy, you're saying?
Democracy, absolute democracy.
Not just the BNP?
Not just the BNP.
There is a real sense here that this election was a step in the right direction. But Mahmoud al-Mustafa questions whether it will lead to lasting change. I meet the political science professor at his University of Dhaka office, where he points out that older Bangladeshis have lived through three uprisings at this point. Each time, he says,
people had huge expectations, and every time they became frustrated. See, you know, democracy is not easy. In democracy, political opponents need to tolerate one another.
Both the BNP and its main rival party, the Awami League, are guilty of using their power to sideline or outright ban their political adversaries. In this recent election, the Awami League, which is Sheikh Hasina's party, was barred from competing altogether. This decision was made under Muhammad Yunus, the Nobel Prize winner who served as the head of the interim government.
Now, the question is, if the government led by such a personality and several other right activists who had long fought for human rights, democratic rights, freedom of expression, their government has barred the major political party of Bangladesh from election, then how can we expect politicians of Bangladesh will behave in a different way amid such level of intolerance? How can democracy flourish?
Aside from the BNP, Jamaat-e-Islami also won big this election. The Islamist party was effectively banned for 17 years under the previous government. And on Thursday, its coalition captured 77 seats in parliament out of a total of 350. Mahmoud al-Mustafa from the University of Dhaka sees the party's success as part of a larger trend.
The share of Islamist vote have become larger and their voices have become louder. This election shows that they have gained political strength and muscle.
The National Citizens Party was created ahead of this election by young people who led the demonstrations that brought down Sheikh Hasina's government. But they were not able to transform their momentum in the streets into votes in the ballot box. The NCP came away with just 6 seats in parliament. Today, members of the party did not seem especially keen to discuss the results.
Nobody from the NCP party is picking up our phone calls today, so we're coming to their office to see if anyone here wants to talk to us.
I stop one of the party's founders, Salahuddin Sifat, as he's walking out of the office, his shirt looking rumpled after sleeping here last night. I ask him what went wrong with the campaign.
Basically, the people from the towns and urban cities saw us in the streets. But you are not just contesting in the urban areas. You are also contesting in the rural areas too, in the villages too.
No amount of visibility, he says, makes up for the half-century head start that the major parties have with building grassroots support among voters nationwide.
We started in February 2025, and it's February 2026, and that's, I think, huge for us.
The winning BNP asked its supporters not to hold victory parties today, but instead to go to Friday prayers. At the National Mosque in Dhaka, the imam gave thanks for a peaceful election. Lawmakers with the BNP also asked the public to pray for the late Khalida Zia. She was the first female prime minister of Bangladesh. Zia just passed away in December. She also happened to be the mother of the soon-to-be new prime minister, Tariq Rahman. It is a reminder that as Bangladesh opens a new political chapter, it is still shaped by the past. For The World, Carolyn Beeler in Dhaka, Bangladesh.
Carolyn will have more reporting for us from Bangladesh in the coming days. As you know, she and I do this hosting gig together. We also do special segments just for The World's YouTube channel, segments like the GeoQuiz. If you follow the show for a while, you may remember that we like to test your knowledge of geography and global trivia. Now it's us, the co-hosts, in the hot seat, and we're not getting easy questions.
I've switched it up every single time. All right.
Are you? Did you? Wow.
Okay. Yeah. I have no allegiances here. Okay. No faith in myself.
We're keeping the faith that you can do better. Play along with us on YouTube, and while you're there, check out what our reporters are looking into through their video stories. We are the World News Radio. Ahead on today's show, Portugal reckons with climate change as flooding takes a major toll. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The rains on the Iberian Peninsula simply will not stop. Multiple storms have forced thousands of people to evacuate their homes. The damage is running into the billions of euros, and Portugal has declared a state of emergency.
We had the fifth storm in a row ending yesterday, and now things will be calmer for a while, but we're already seeing potentially another formation of another depression in the middle of the Atlantic.
So possibly more storms on the horizon, according to João Diniz. He's the climate action director for the Portuguese city of Cascais on the south coast. When we spoke earlier today, he told me that as of current estimates, around 17 people have died. Meanwhile, part of the major highway connecting Lisbon to the north has collapsed.
It's pretty severe. We've been having extreme winds, record-breaking winds. In the central region, we had winds nearly 200 kilometers per hour. And in my region in particular, we had winds of 130 kilometers per hour. So this much.
That's about 70 miles an hour. That's pretty strong.
Yeah, 70 miles an hour, but we had this for over 5 hours straight. And this has been going on for multiple weeks. So the problem with climate is it's never just one meteorological factor. It's multiple. So not only did we have these strong winds, but if you associate with the soils being completely saturated with water from the extreme rainfall that we've been having at the same time, which weakens the trees holding onto the ground, right? So then we have these strong winds come, so trees start to fall, they crack, they endanger people, they endanger houses. And so it's a very complex situation that we have to deal here and so on.
Joel, can you give us a sense of what this amount of water looks like? Just draw us a picture, because from the video I've seen, it's dramatic.
So for example, in the Portuguese city of Cascais, we have a nearly rainfall of around 700 millimeters. And imagine if you're standing and you have water basically, I would say up to your shoulders, perhaps, as a normal adult. That would be the amount of water all across the municipality or the landmass that you have. And unfortunately, in just 2 months, we've had that amount of rainfall. And I actually did a calculation yesterday. So we had 200 millimeters in February so far, and we're only on the 13th. And in January, we had another 200. And in December, we had another 200. And this is in my region. It doesn't mean that in other regions, this wasn't even more severe, which apparently it was.
Water up to your shoulders, that's extraordinary, and you can understand the risk to human safety. What areas in Portugal have been hit the hardest?
Well, all across Portugal, but I would say the central area of continental Portugal, the north area, and of course the southern region of Lisbon with heavy floods. And unfortunately, we just received news that we've had some water retention infrastructures collapsing.
I saw a video of what you mentioned, what happened after one levee burst. It actually caused part of a major highway to collapse. Is this an issue of infrastructure in Portugal not being maintained or up to par, or is this just truly an unmanageable amount of water?
It's an unmanageable amount of water. I have to say that we have good infrastructure in Portugal. However, usually after, let's say, one single storm, the amount of rain, when it's too much, you get the soils completely saturated. But then over time, these soils start to drain, everything starts to get back into normal balance. But when you have so many storms, one after the other, 2 days between them, there's absolutely no way for the ecosystems to recover. So there's possibly no way that infrastructure can hold all this. So it's all about now understanding what can we do, what can we change, how can we adapt to this climate change reality that we are facing.
I'm speaking with João Diniz, the climate action director for the Portuguese city of Cascais. So this sort of weather is not really unexpected. I mean, the Iberian Peninsula has seen increasing extreme weather events in recent years, including catastrophic flooding. What would you say, though, is different this time, João?
That's a good question. And one of the best things that I can say, well, at least in my field of expertise, is that climate change doesn't bring anything new, but it brings these extreme weather events much more often and more powerful. And that connection, yes, it is new. So we've always had storms, right? But now they come more often, more frequent. Then we've always had wind speeds of, let's say, wind gusts of 150, even 200 kilometers per hour. Well, yeah, but not with this intensity, frequency, and during this duration. So that's new. And the Iberian Peninsula, in fact, has been facing extreme weather events that have been record-breaking. And these range from extreme hot days, heat waves, flooding events that come from extreme precipitation, and coastal erosion.
As a climate action director, Joao, what steps have you taken and what more needs doing to make sure your city is prepared in the future?
Well, first of all, I think we are collaborating. Secondly, I think it's very important to trust what is known as nature-based solutions. So basically, restoring the ecosystem services in cities can help to create a greater weather resilience in cities. And finally, we need to map and we need to measure what is going on. So this allows us, for example, to develop a response plan much quicker and you know, with greater impact on the livelihoods of everyone that lives in our municipality, in our city.
How has the public responded across the country to these floods and the weather?
Well, I would like to state, firstly, the solidarity. I think that different populations try to help as much as they could. I saw some companies renting, or in this case, giving away some trucks so people could transport their belongings left and right. You know, this is an extreme situation. There are people that lost everything that they had. So people are a bit, there's obviously some tension. There's obviously lots of emotions and the need to speed up this going back to normality. And I think that those emotions sometimes, you know, they prompt to let's say, a little alarmism, but which is normal.
Alarmism, yeah. Well, that emotional component makes me a little hesitant to ask this next question, but at what point do you start to have the conversation of people can't live here anymore and the idea of a managed move away from a particular location, a place that a lot of people call home?
Good question, though. I would say that in Portugal, generally speaking, we do not need to move away. Perhaps in some regions, we need to rethink, are we going to keep up rebuilding what's been damaged? Or are we going to actually build elsewhere and just don't invest anymore on that? I think that what we really need to ask is, can we continue to live like this and be so vulnerable to these extreme weather events and to the climate change scenarios that are happening already? Because if we say, no, we need to adapt quickly, then we need to heavily reinvest the way we are using our national policies and our local policies to prioritize stable and sustained infrastructure, reply to extreme weather events that can cope and can improve the local resilience to these extreme weather events. So we don't need to move. We need to preserve and we need to adapt. I would say that would be the greatest policy that we could achieve as a country.
Joao Diniz is the Climate Action Director for Quiscais, Portugal. We'll be keeping our eye on the flooding in Southern Europe as it develops. This is The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Israel's bombing of Gaza for more than 2 years has killed more than 70,000 people, according to health officials in Gaza. The damage to the infrastructure of the Palestinian territory has also been extensive, including at historic and archaeological sites. The UN cultural agency UNESCO has been conducting an assessment of the damage based on satellite images. Krista Pickett is the director of UNESCO's Culture and Emergencies Entity. She spoke with the Associated Press about what they found.
We have verified damage to 150 sites, 14 religious sites, 115 buildings of historic or artistic interest, three depositories, one museum, nine monuments, and eight archaeological sites. Every site, every cultural site that is damaged, that is not accessible, that is lost, is a huge loss for the communities, but also for the humankind in general.
Almost all of the schools in Gaza were either damaged or destroyed during the war, and nearly all of the population has been displaced. Since a shaky ceasefire came into effect last October, young Palestinians have been slowly going back to class. Now they have to catch up on what they've missed. It is a monumental task, as the world's Shirin Jafari reports.
15-year-old Maria Bakr has always wanted to become a doctor. She's standing in front of a white tent in Gaza. Israeli drones are hovering above, something that has become a part of life here. Bakr lost her father and cousin in the war. She was forced to move around several times. The whole ordeal left her traumatized and anxious, she says. I haven't been able to study at all since the war began, she tells our producer in Gaza. Bakr says before the war, she used to get high grades. Now, she expects them to be much lower. Inside a nearby tent, 30-year-old Aya Matar is teaching a class. Students sit on plastic chairs. They're in fourth grade. For more than 2 years, these students haven't set foot inside a classroom. Matar says she has to raise her voice to be heard over the loud sound of the drones. She says the drones are a constant reminder that they live under occupation. To be honest, the war hasn't stopped, Matar explains. Even to this day, we are nervous. I wish everything in the sky would just disappear and for the bombing to end. I need some peace of mind, Matar says. I need safety. I need a home. Before the recent war, Gaza had around 700,000 school-aged children. None have received formal education for more than 2 years.
The situation of schools in the Gaza Strip is a complete catastrophe.
Jonathan Cricks is chief of communications for UNICEF Palestine. He says the schools and universities that are still standing are being used as shelters for displaced families.
Most of the children, they don't have enough clothes, they don't have access to enough water. You still have a situation where most of the vulnerable families cannot afford buying food that is now on the market.
Teachers have been killed or displaced. Many are struggling with daily life, just like the students and their families. But in recent weeks, Crick says Israel has allowed some educational material to enter Gaza.
Huge boxes where you can find everything for the teachers and the children to teach basic writing, reading, mathematics, and a bit of science. So really the bare minimum.
That is making a difference for the children and their teachers, he says. There are now about 100 temporary learning spaces, think tents with chairs and a whiteboard. Noor Abu Maryam is with the Gaza Great Minds, a nonprofit that focuses on education in Gaza.
We are trying to help as much as children to help them fill the gaps that they lost during all these 2 years.
One key need for the students, she says, is mental help. They have all been through an extremely traumatic time, Abu Maryam says. Some have lost family and friends. These learning spaces can help them heal. Jonathan Cricks of UNICEF says it is hard to quantify the amount of learning loss the war in Gaza has caused. What is clear, he says, is that children must return to a safe environment where they can receive an education.
They just want to have the possibility to learn and to be able to build a future for themselves.
As the class wraps up for the day, the students spill out of the tent, their backpacks on their shoulders. They head home, which for many is yet another tent. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Kenya is slated to reopen its border with Somalia. That border has been closed for nearly 15 years. News of the reopening comes by way of an announcement from Kenya's president, William Ruto.
Kwa hivyo, mimi narudi hapa mwezi wa nne kuja kufungua ile border post.
Speaking from a border town, Ruto said he hoped to boost cross-border trade for the mutual prosperity of people in both nations. The border was closed in October 2011 due to attacks in Kenya by Al-Shabaab, the Islamist militant group based in Somalia. Ruto said that the reopening plan will include a deployment of security forces to ensure safety at border checkpoints. One more update on a story we're watching out of Asia. South Korea's spy agency says that North Korea's government is getting close to naming Kim Jong-un's daughter as his successor. Kim Ju-ae is believed to be just 13 years old. She's appeared at official events and in North Korean propaganda alongside her father. But beyond that, there's not a lot known about her. Officials from the National Intelligence Service in Seoul told lawmakers on Thursday that the elder Kim is planning a big political meeting later this month and that he is planning to name the teenager as his designated successor. She would be the fourth generation of the Kim dynasty to rule over North Korea. Think of them as criminal call centers. They've been operating for years across Southeast Asia, but now a reckoning has come for these so-called scam compounds. In recent months, Thailand has bombarded them with F-16 airstrikes. Myanmar's military has blown up a few compounds with explosives. Now the action is in Cambodia, where police are raiding facilities left and right, sending scam workers spilling into the streets. Reporter Patrick Nguyen reports on this multi-state crackdown and why it's happening now.
The compounds are big, some big as small cities, and they're filled with men and women hustling 24/7 to screw people out of their savings through online scams.
You know, I started to notice these structures pop up.
Jacob Goodland is an American who's lived in Cambodia for 16 years. He was mystified when compounds appeared a few years back not far from his home, around Bokor, a beautiful mountain. They're like giant office parks with gates and high-rise towers. Goodland, a former Marine, sensed something was off. Something was fishy.
So I just kind of checked these places out and noticed that they're well-guarded.
Last year, Cambodia's scam centers raked in $12 to $19 billion, according to various estimates. That's roughly one-third of Cambodia's economy. They run romance scams or fake investment scams. Cambodia has at least 50 big compounds, at least until recently. Hundreds of workers breaking free from a huge compound in Cambodia in a recent video apparently filmed by one of the people escaping. These jailbreaks keep happening. The fleeing scammers are almost always foreigners who've been locked inside, unable to quit once they've taken the job or been tricked into working there. In some cases, their bosses have vanished, allowing everyone inside to run free. In other cases, the boss gets arrested by Cambodia's police barging in with guns drawn. This is no regular crackdown, says a Cambodian government spokesman in an online warning. We're eliminating every compound by April. They've already raided nearly 200. This is quite a turn. The scam tycoons running these compounds have connections. One scam center mogul named Chen Ji from China was an advisor to Cambodia's government. He owned yachts and a Picasso. Then last month, he showed up on Chinese state TV with shackled wrists and a black bag over his head. Chen was extradited to China at Beijing's request. China is the driver behind this assault on scam compounds. Beijing is pressuring the whole region, Thailand, Myanmar, Cambodia, to wipe them out and hand over the scam bosses. Virtually all are Chinese citizens. Not only is their notoriety a black mark on China's image, but many scam victims are Chinese citizens. Footage of a judge in China sentencing scam operators to death. In recent weeks, China has executed 15, and more executions are expected to come. Few will shed tears for a scam boss. As for the workers who fled their compounds, that's more complicated.
There are people just wandering the streets.
Monse Ferrer is a researcher with Amnesty International, which has interviewed hundreds of escapees. They're from all over. Ghana, Indonesia, Pakistan, Brazil.
They are suddenly in a country that they do not know anything of. They don't speak the language, and they have no ID.
Their passports get confiscated by bosses. Now many of those bosses are on the run. Amnesty calls this a humanitarian crisis and requests a global effort to help stranded foreigners. Seeking sympathy for scammers can be a tough sell.
I understand that people may feel reluctant to think of people who've been involved directly or indirectly in scamming others as victims, but that's a reality that exists.
Last year, Cambodian scam compounds bilked $10 billion from Americans alone, according to the U.S. government. Many Americans have lost their life savings. But Ferrer says the people carrying out those scams were often beaten or tortured with shock batons, even traded around like slaves.
Many of them were sold. There are networks across different compounds where individuals are sold from one compound to another, depending on what they're able or not able to do.
Now they're sleeping on sidewalks in Cambodia's capital, Phnom Penh, or they're held in a makeshift holding center, an old airport hangar outside the city. Some have mobile phones, and almost daily, they post scenes of desperation. An Indonesian woman in the hangar, surrounded by a crowd, pleading with authorities. Please, she says, send us home. Jacob Goodland, the former Marine, has been monitoring this crackdown. He's taken his motorbike up the mountain to check on those big scam compounds.
So it's crazy. It's just completely deserted now. So all those compounds that I could see were vacant.
For now, he says, this crackdown looks legit. But with so many billions to be made from online scams, he's sure they'll try to pop up somewhere else very soon. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
It's almost Valentine's Day, so we're treating you romantics out there to a lesson in dramatic expressions of love. In Mexico, there's a flower delivery trend you need to know about because, you know, why send just flowers when you can send a whole show? The World's TV's Isaiah checked it out for us.
It starts in a children's classroom in Mexico City when a stranger calls out from the hallway.
Señorita Lily?
Miss Lily? The teacher looks up a little confused. Yes, she says.
Le mando unas flores al patrón.
The boss is sending you flowers. No way, she says. And then, boom. A man in a flashy shirt and cowboy boots runs into the school courtyard, shouting from afar. Miss Lily, you're a lucky teacher, he shouts. Confetti flies, and pretty soon the whole school is outside. Miss Lily looks surprised, maybe a little embarrassed, but smiling. It's not exactly the kind of moment you plan for, but scenes like this have gone viral across Mexico, in restaurants, public plazas, offices, bus stops, anywhere. The man behind the idea is not an actor or an influencer. His name is Raúl Tupac, a biomedical engineer that came up with this idea during the pandemic, when jobs dried up and he had to get creative.
Y empecé a vender muchas cosas. O sea, he vendido gomitas, he vendido ropa, he vendido...
He started selling whatever he could. Candy, clothes, anything. Then he landed on something more personal, flowers.
Amor siempre va a haber, ¿no? Entonces, si hay amor, siempre va a haber alguien que regale flores.
There will always be love, right? So there will always be someone giving flowers, he says. Then he added music, sometimes live music if the client hires a mariachi band. He added a special dance, lots of confetti, and what became his signature shout from 50 or 60 feet away. That's to catch the attention of the lucky señorita and anyone around, really. The flower bouquets are huge. The smallest have 50 roses, and others have over 1,000. So heavy that he needs help to lift them up. He's delivered them on horseback, by motorbike, even by boat. always wears a flamboyant shirt and cowboy boots, a style that borrows from that of narco culture, that flashy world of drug lords and their girlfriends. Even the name of his business, Flores el Patrón, or Flowers from the Boss, is a nod to narco culture. Tupac says he's just trying to make people smile. And it works. His videos have pulled in millions of views. Most are sweet, with the occasional heartbreak.
Sí nos ha pasado que nos las rechazan. Hacemos todo el show y, oiga, no, dile que no, no las quiero.
He remembers the time a bouquet was meant to win back an ex, and she turned it down, on camera. That was awkward, he says. Raúl Tupac's idea has been copied by others across Mexico and even in the U.S. In cities like Los Angeles and Houston, you can now book your own patron-style bouquet, oversized, dramatic, and impossible to ignore. Felicidades, felicidades, felicidades. For the world, I'm Tivisa Isea, Mexico City. Felicidades, felicidades, que tengas dicha toda la vida.
TB first reported that story over the summer. We brought it back for you with Valentine's Day in mind. A tap dancer in New York has an Instagram following that is in the tens of thousands. And there's a reason for that. The Japanese dancer posts exuberant videos in front of New York City landmarks, the Brooklyn Bridge, Times Square, Central Park, overlaying edgy pop music with tapping. Reporter Jeff London had a chance to chat with Emiko Nakagawa recently in a Manhattan dance studio.
Tap dance is my life.
In a midtown studio with mirrors and ballet bars, it takes no time to get Emiko Nakagawa up and dancing. The slim, energetic dancer sports a black turtleneck and gray cargo pants, and her feet create complex rhythms in a way that seems effortless. The 28-year-old from Tokyo has been tap dancing almost her entire life. Nakagawa started when she was 6 years old and says she was immediately hooked.
When I took the tap dance class for the first time, I feel like, oh, it is very interesting because I can create a rhythm by myself and I can introduce my own rhythm to the other people.
This is from one of her Instagram videos, where Nakagawa dances to Eminem's Slim Shady. She moved to New York in 2021 to study in the international program at the Broadway Dance Center, which is where she began creating short videos set to hip-hop and contemporary pop music in streets and parks around the city.
You know, the speed and clarity of her footwork, of her choreography is remarkable and fascinating. I mean, it draws you in.
Tap dancer Ryan P. Casey profiled Emiko Nakagawa in Dance Magazine's 25 Dancers to Watch in 2026. And we're talking the 25 up-and-coming dancers to watch from the whole of dance, ballet, modern, Broadway, all over the world.
She consistently churns out these speedy, intricate, mesmerizing videos, oftentimes on a small tap board, which is also intriguing because the limitation of space is such an interesting factor.
Nakagawa creates this magic on a foldable wooden board just a little bigger than a doormat. And the videos are shot from below, so you have a view not just of her feet, but her whole body and the location.
I really love to show my people who followed me on my Instagram both of the beautiful New York view and my tap dance style.
Nakagawa developed her style by studying traditional American tap dance technique in Tokyo with a teacher who rigorously trained her. So she knows old-style tap, but her choice of music and movement is definitely now.
How can I explain? I just want to do this street style to move a little bigger, like widely, with my tap dancing. I just want to combine hip hop, like street style, and tap dancing. This is my style. Yeah.
Her first Instagram hit was set to Eminem's Gorilla, which she recreates in the dance studio.
What I admire so much about Emiko at this point in her journey is she's extremely technically capable, but she's also very interested in style.
That's Caleb Teicher, a BESSY Award-winning dancer. They first came across Emiko Nakagawa on Instagram and have since become a mentor and collaborator.
She doesn't just make a lot of sounds, and those sounds aren't just clean, but she is formulating a personal expression, a personal perspective through tap dance. When I see Emiko dance, I know it is Emiko dancing, even if I didn't see her face or the outline of her body. I would know it's her way of dancing.
Here are the two of them on an Instagram video trading solos. She may be young, but Nakagawa has already danced with tap superstars like Michelle Dorrance in places like the Joyce Theater and Jacob's Pillow. And she says she has big dreams, dancing on Broadway one day, and...
One of the biggest dreams for me is to be a bridge between other countries in Japan. Because the Japanese tap dance community is very small. So it needs to be inspired by other countries' artists. So I really want to bring the tap dance spirit of New York.
Spirit is a word Emiko Nakagawa uses a lot. And it's something she finds hard to contain. When we talk, she's soft-spoken and still. But when she dances, she's electric. Here's Caleb Teicher.
She has a long journey ahead of her. She's still quite young, and even though she's done a lot and has amassed a great following and has some great credits to her name, she has a lot more she can do as a dancer and choreographer, a tap dance artist. So I'm excited to see what she does.
For The World, I'm Jeff London, New York.
Finally today, a note about loyalty. The state of Sao Paulo in Brazil has a new law that will allow pets to be buried alongside their owners. It's called the Bob Covero Law. Bob, that's the name of a dog, and Covero, meaning gravedigger in Portuguese. I'll explain. Bob's owner died in 2010. Bob went to the man's graveside in a cemetery outside Sao Paulo and would not leave. Even after relatives of the late owner tried to take him away, Bob found his way back to the cemetery to stay by the man's side for the next 10 years. Workers at the cemetery took care of Bob and built him a doghouse. As a cemetery dog, Bob attended funerals and got national attention for walking alongside processions. 5 years ago, Bob wandered out of the cemetery, was struck by a car, and killed, prompting an exception to the law that prohibits burial of animals next to humans. This week, that exception became the law across Sao Paulo State, where all pets can now be buried with their human families. There's also a statue of Bob in the cemetery in honor of the devotion he showed to his owner. A plaque reads, "Our tribute and gratitude for your lessons in love and loyalty." I'm not the first to say it, but we really do not deserve dogs. R.I.P. Bob Covero in Sao Paulo. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Have a relaxing weekend.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Judy Pigott. The Gruber Family Foundation, the Schmidt Family Foundation, and Gavin Salmanis, LLC. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
PRX. From PRX.